I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Lieutenant Joe Pangaro here. Today, in an interview with somebody, a business associate, Mr. Dotan Saji. Dotan and his company, Best Be Strategic, they provide electronic tabletop software that I use when I help to keep people safe for training, for OEM, police, schools, all that kind of stuff. We're not going to talk about that today. I just wanted you to know who Dotan is. He's a good and decent man, and he lives in Tel Aviv, Israel. Well, in the last couple days, we were having some business meetings. We were talking, having some conversations about some upcoming projects that we have. And unfortunately, there's bombing going on over in Israel, in Tel Aviv. There's rockets coming, flying in to the neighborhoods. People have been killed. The Israeli Defense Forces have responded to the rocket shooters over in the Gaza Strip, and Palestinians have been killed. It is a difficult situation. I've asked Dotan if he would be able to get to the microphone and talk to us for a few minutes about what it's like over there. See, I think sometimes we see these things, but all we see is news reports. We don't see the real world. And here is a man who is living there with his family. And he's going to tell you what's been going on the last couple of days. And it's truly frightening what's going on. But Dotan is a really great guy. And we will have a direct connection to what's going on over there. Direct reporting. You know, the rest of the show today, I'm going to concentrate on some police-related issues. You know, some police-related issues of what's going on out in the world, and talking about some things that I'm doing for the police officers. We're talking a little bit about Tales from the Road. I'm going to give you some information on what that is. That is some compilations I'm putting together of stories about police officers, police work, what it's like to really be a cop. We're going to put that together in a book or a series of books. And I got officers going to be calling in from all over, sending me their stories and telling me what it's like for them in the different parts of the country. So I think we're gonna find all of that stuff interesting. So we're going to talk about that today. It's going to be a law enforcement-centered kind of a show today. But I also wanted to include this interview with Dotan just to give us some real-world perspective on things that are going on in parts of the globe that are really unfamiliar to us. You know, here in America, we have the specter of civil unrest now, really for the first time, mass civil unrest across the country. Last summer was a nightmare. We see the growing violence in American cities. We see active shooters. We see people who are PTSD afflicted because of the COVID. We're seeing increases in violence there. So I think this is important for us to pay attention to. And even though it's not the same, it's going to be a firsthand view of what's going on in the news in Israel today. The only real democracy in the entire region is our friends in Israel. And one of the things I don't understand is the way the media portrays this. You know, both sides should stand down. Both sides should give peace a chance. Well, the Israelis did not start this. The Israelis did not start lobbing rockets into the Gaza Strip and going after the Palestinians. They started lobbing rockets into Israel, and Israel responded. I'm going to get Dotan on here, and you can hear from him what it's like to be in that part of the world.
Now, right now in America, we have an increase in crime. We have lots of problems going on. We have active shooters here, workplace violence people. But it's not happening in our neighborhoods. It's not happening to our families, over our heads, where you have to run and hide, all of us, in an entire community. So my friend Dotan here lives there. He lives amongst this, and I wanted to bring him on. He's going to give us a little flavor of what it's like, because I think they were running and hiding yesterday. So Dotan, how are you? Welcome aboard.
Hi, Joseph. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad you're safe. I'm glad your family's good. You know, yesterday you sent me that message and said, hey, I may not be available for wire because we're going to the bomb shelter. Absolutely amazing in this modern world. So give us a little flavor of the neighborhood you're in. You know, what's it normally like? And then tell us about, you know, rockets flying into your neighborhood.
Okay, so I live in the suburbs of Tel Aviv, the northern part. It's a neighborhood with high-rise buildings. You could imagine buildings with 13, 12, 13 stories. I know in the United States it's not high-rise, but for us it is. Very nice neighborhood, you know, a lot of parks, people walking outside all the time, and morning everyone goes out to work, and in the afternoon everyone comes back. A normal suburb life. The last few days, you know, life changes a little. It is important to know that in Israel, new apartments since the 1980s, every apartment has to have a bomb shelter as part of the apartment. One of the rooms in the apartment is reinforced, concrete, steel, that allows the family members to go there and hide there when something happens. So we continue with our lives, we enjoy ourselves until rockets start flying around us.
So that's something that's probably, different for most Americans. I mean, some people back in the 60s, they built bomb shelters in the backyard, because we were expecting the Russians to nuke us at some point. But when they build new apartment complexes and houses too, I'm going to assume, right? When you build a house,
Of course.
it's mandated that you have a bomb shelter in your house because this is not like a once every 50 year kind of a thing, right? How often?
No, it isn't. Look, the people in the south of Israel, this is a weekly occurrence. When there's high tension, it's a daily occurrence. When there's low tension, then it's a weekly or monthly occurrence. For us in Tel Aviv, it happens around it once a year, but then it's for a few days of rockets flying and exploding over our heads. It is mandated. The government of Israel understood a long time ago that in order for it to be able to operate against terror organizations, and it's not a sprint, it's always a marathon, you need the home front to be field protected. And the way to do it is to give people peace so they can live. And that's the only way to do it. Every school has shelters, every workplace. So it's part of our lives.
Right. Now, for people who don't know exactly, the layout, where, Tel Aviv is the capital, correct?
Jerusalem is the capital.
Jerusalem, oh, that's right.
We
Capital. That's right.
yeah, but Tel Aviv is the place to be. Tel Aviv is the place to, but don't tell the people from Jerusalem, please.
If I look at the state and I see that it's longer than it is wide, whereabouts is Tel Aviv, in the top, bottom, or the middle?
Tel Aviv is exactly somewhere in the center of Israel. We sit on the Mediterranean Sea. So I'm looking out to the north, to my left, to the west is the Mediterranean Sea. And about 20 kilometers is the eastern border of Israel. Israel is long in our terms, we're about 800 kilometers, but very narrow. So there are places where from east to west could be 100 kilometers. But there are places where it's 15, 17 to be exact, kilometers. I don't know in miles, you'll have to do that equation yourself.
And it's interesting because New Jersey, the state of New Jersey, which most people in America know, they see it on a map, it's this little blip. We're kind of the same way. We're long and skinny in the middle, but we're not very big. So Tel Aviv is kind of in the middle. Now we keep hearing that these rockets are coming from the Gaza Strip. How far away is that from you?
Gaza is about 100 and something kilometers from here, maybe a little less.
I think it's
Yeah,
about
you know what
60
about?
miles or so. I think 100
Yeah,
kilometers,
maybe
about
even
60
80
miles.
kilometers. Yeah,
Right.
depends because Tel Aviv is a big city, so you know.
Right. Okay.
It's
So when these rockets fly, I think a lot of people picture them like shoulder fired rockets. These are going 80 miles. They're serious rockets.
They are serious rockets and they can cause a lot of damage when they hit buildings. And what they've been doing is we have a protective technology called Iron Dome. And the way that they found to push the limits is they fire hundreds of rockets at the same time. So you can have a barrage yesterday evening, that's what happened, of about 160 rockets flying at the same time towards Tel Aviv. And some of them will get through. Some of
Right
them will
now,
get through.
you sent me a video that a friend of yours took in your neighborhood of the Iron Dome, which for people to understand it, we have Star Wars technology was kind of the bigger scale of that kind of a thing for nuclear bombs. So the Iron Dome, As the rockets are coming over, it fires multiple warheads from your end, which targets the incoming rockets and then blows them up in the sky so that they don't land on your buildings and kill people.
Exactly. And it's more than that. The moment the rocket departs the Gaza Strip, radar identifies the path that it's going to fly. Immediately in the estimated area of landing, alarms will go off. So in Tel Aviv is divided into four quadrants. So all four quadrants, the alarms can go on, and then you'll hear them. You can't hide from it. You can hear the noise everywhere. You can't miss it. And you have hundreds of these. Israel is divided into hundreds of these quadrants, and the alarms will go off. So that allows you and gives you the time to reach the shelter. That's number one. Now, the closer you are to the Gaza Strip, the less time you have. My daughter last year volunteered in a kibbutz on the border. They had 15 seconds. So the moment the alarm goes off, you have 15 seconds. In most cases, you won't reach the shelter. You're going to have to, they have these special blocks where you lie down, cover your head, and you wait for things to go over. We in Tel Aviv had 90 seconds. Now, 90 seconds is a long time. You'll be surprised what you can do in 90 seconds. I know it sounds weird, but it's crazy.
Well, I'll tell you, as weird as it sounds, we talk about that when we talk about how to survive an active shooter. And the phrase that I use all the time is time equals life. So from the time the shooter announces themselves, the longer you can survive, the better. So if I know that they're at the front door trying to get in and break the glass, now I have time to go lock down and hide myself. It's the same thing that you're talking about.
Same thing.
You're hearing a siren and you got to go.
The same technology, the Iron Dome, when it knows the path, it starts firing these rockets or missiles, I don't know how to say it in English, to intercept the rockets coming in from Gaza. So you can have hundreds of them just flying over your head and you'll hear the explosions. A lot of the damage that is created is from these rockets being blown up in the sky, because you can have 5 minutes after it happened. That's why when there's an alarm and you hide, you have to wait 10 minutes, because you can have 5 or 6 minutes after the Iron Dome has blown something up and suddenly pieces of metal start falling on your car or in the street.
Unbelievable.
People have been injured just from that.
So what you're describing so far is really so foreign to us here in America, that even out in the street, you have places where people know where to hide. They can duck down. There's protection. This is part of everyday life.
It is.
To what you do there. And our perception over here, you know, I remember talking to you about, you know, you were going to the park, you were going to the mountains, you're going camping. Wait a minute, I thought you're on a constant war footing, but everyone seems pretty resilient there, that you do it and you go on. Is that right?
It is. You have to be resilient. Today, even though school had been closed, my wife is a headmaster, so she stayed with the children at home. I decided to go to work, even though I let the employees work from home. It's important for us to show this message for my clients, for my employees, and to my government, that we are behind you. We will not back down. We will not stop. We will give you the power and the time that you need to do whatever you need to do. And it's a big thing. People are going out to restaurants. There is a threat this evening that Tel Aviv will be barraged again, if that's the right word, I apologize. My son, who is 15, has a shift today. He works at a burger joint 3 times a week. So he told me today, I want to go to work. So I said, do you have the shelter? So he said, yes. So I said, okay, the only thing that's different today is that I'm coming with the car to pick you up at 10 p.m. because I don't want you walking at night by yourself, because the streets are emptier at night today.
Sure.
There's nothing
sure.
we can do about that. But other than that, life continues, and that's the message that has to get across. You cannot defeat us.
And you know what? And I think that's always been the American can-do way. We're not going to give in. We don't give up to these things. But you live it every day. Your family lives it, and the people of Israel have always been so amazing to me that you just soldier on. You've created this democracy in the middle of nowhere. You have enemies all around you. And all you want is peace and security for everybody. I mean, in your country, there's Palestinians, there's Arab personnel that have seats in your government. They live in your community, and
exactly.
they have rights in your community. If you went to the Gaza Strip, would you have rights over there?
No, Even different ethnic groups in the population in Israel would not have any rights over there. By the way, they are even politically, you know, the different factions, they are, when they're not trying to kill us, they're trying to kill each other. Now, it's a rough neighborhood. I'm not saying we're angels. I'll be the last one to say we're angels. But in a rough neighborhood, sometimes you have to stand up to the bully and tell him,
right,
you know, I'll smack you on the head if you try to do something.
Now, you know, I don't want to take this down a political road for either one of us. But what I'm saying is that when every time I see this happen, I'm an American. I watch the news and I see Tel Aviv or one of the other cities is bombarded with rockets. Our news media here and the perception here from a lot of people is that, well, Israel started it. And now these occupied people, they call them, are firing back. What actually starts these kind of conflicts?
So there's always a lot of factors here. Let's remember that in the Gaza Strip, Israel left more than 15 years ago. It's not an occupied place. They manage it. In fact, they had an election, and when Hamas defeated the Palestinian Authority in that election, they killed all the Palestinian Authority members that were there. We're not there. We're not in their land anyway. This week, it's always things that are influencing from the outside. It's not only internal. There was supposed to be an election in the Palestinian Authority on the West Bank. Abu Mazen, who heads it, probably felt that he's going to lose, and he canceled the elections where the Hamas was supposed to win. And they can't try to kill each other, so they have to create a noise, and we're right. Stuck in the middle.
So you're a distraction to their internal
exactly.
Politics. But my point is, does Israel ever start just like sending the IDF over there to start bombing places for no reason?
No, there are the only incidents where the IDF has done something proactively and not reactively there is when intelligence sources say there's what we call a ticking bomb. When there is a ticking bomb of information that something is going to happen, then we address. Israel's, and this is critical to understand, we are a very small country. I mean, 800 kilometers long, we said, and 20 to 100 kilometers wide. We are surrounded by, since 48, today some of them are peaceful countries, but by enemy states. The Israeli DNA, which is what makes us sometimes abrasive or rude, as people would say, is that we cannot fight a war on our own land. We cannot, you know, the United States, you're big. If Mexico or Canada or anyone started to attack you, you could take a hit, regroup, and push back. You can't take a hit in 20 kilometers and push back. There's no way. So whatever war takes place, it has to happen on the other side. You have to proactively identify and address it before. And that's complicated. That's complex.
Sure.
But most cases where Israel has been proactive and not reactive, it's been because of these ticking bombs. On Monday, everything started with the rockets being shot into Jerusalem. Don't remember, it's the end of Ramadan. We have a holiday. It's, you know, these are tensions that we're running anyway.
Right. And that's always been my experience, is that it's Israel being attacked and responding to defend itself. Or, like you said, a ticking time bomb. If you know that they're massing up ready to go, it would be irresponsible to not go and stop that attack before it starts. Because other than that, I think everybody would just live in peace. You know, let's just all be peaceful. You got your thing, we got our thing, you know, but there's a lot more complications here to it.
So it is.
Let me ask you this. When you hear that siren yesterday, did you get evacuated yesterday or did you just go to the bomb shelter? What happened?
No, I'll tell you. First of all, we knew it's going to happen. As you see the things escalating, you have enough experience to know that if you pass certain points, it's going to happen. On yesterday morning, school was still taking place. So I didn't know if it would happen that morning, afternoon. My wife went to work, I went to work, but this is a different day. So you tell your, I have two sons living at home. So I told them, I had a talk with them, a briefing. Today's a different day. There may be alarms, we may be barraged. Remember, remain calm, doesn't matter whatever happens. Don't run into the street because more people can be killed or injured by running hysterically into the street or into the wrong place. Breathe and start counting. Start counting. You can count up to 90. We always practice it. And so when you reach 50,
you practice that with your children.
Yes, yes. You practice active shooter, right? Turn the table or whatever you do.
Right. You're right.
We do that.
Our kids to lock down because the bad man is coming to kill them. And we do this with young children. We do it with everyone. It just seems so different when it's bombs flying through the air.
Exactly.
An individual coming into a place. So.
So I tell him, you start counting and you look for to enter one of the buildings on the way to school or a shelter. If you reach 60 and you haven't found a place, then you lie next to the closest wall and you cover your head with your hands until you hear the alarm stop. And then you look at your cell phone, because a child doesn't know how to estimate 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And you look at your cell phone and see the 10 minutes. In the evening, it was a little different. You know, you're sitting at home. Hamas had said they would fire at 6 o'clock. At 9 o'clock. They fired at 8:45, a little earlier than anticipated. My older son was outside. He had been playing basketball with his friends. But we had talked. He knew which building he would have to run into. Another thing is that we're a very strong community. All the buildings, which are usually the doors are locked and there's a code for the building members to go in, they open the doors and they keep them open. So anyone who wants to could run in and hide in the stairway or whatever. So everyone knows that you can, wherever you are in the neighborhood, there'll be somewhere you can hide. So when someone's playing basketball, we were watching TV, and then you hear the noise. And it doesn't matter how many times you've been there, your heart does a... The surge of adrenaline is there.
Sure.
But you have time. My son had prepared the room. He had used the time and he bought enough snacks. I think we could close the room down for about 24 months of sugar and whatever he put there. So we go into the room. I was still worried about my older son. So my wife had locked the door. You have a big door. We locked the door and I waited outside because I wanted to see that my elder son was able to get back home. And once I knew that he was safe, I also walked into the room. That 9 o'clock continued for about 40 minutes. And it's tough because you hear explosions outside, but you can't see what's happening because you don't want to open the window, the metal windows and everything. So you open TV, you joke a little, you pass the 40 minutes, you know, and then you continue with life.
Absolutely amazing, Dotan. I can't thank you enough for being here. This is like you're right there while this is happening. And while there are similarities and things we have to deal with when it comes to violence, that is just such a different experience for most Americans. I'm glad they got to hear from you, a father, a husband, a businessman, a citizen of Israel who's just trying to survive, and people are throwing rockets at you. And you go on. Your spirit is amazing, the Israeli people. I'm a great, great fan of the State of Israel for its democracy and for its people and their resilience. So I'd like to thank you for being on here and wish you best of luck and be safe.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, Joseph.
Today, America stands at the crossroads of history. Our actions will determine the fate of our nation. Well, that journey starts here and starts now. We invite you to join us in making the ultimate difference. Subscribe to our podcast and newsletters. Turn notifications on and stay in the know. You'll find all that back at AmericaOutloud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
I want to talk for a few minutes about people in crisis. Now, we are seeing what I have called an outrageous amount of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. This is going on in our country because of the pandemic. We are seeing people affected by this to very small amounts, minuscule reactions to this PTSD. And then we're seeing people who are really pushed to their mental limits because of this PTSD, because of these lockdowns and the way things are going. So how are we supposed to deal with? How do we identify it? What do we look at? Well, one of the things I talk about, as a trained hostage crisis negotiator, one of the things we learn is how to recognize people in crisis. That's one of the first things we have to do. Is this person in crisis or is this person just having a bad day? There's a big difference between having a bad day and someone who's actually in a crisis and someone who's in a crisis and could potentially be dangerous. So I think one of the first distinctions we have to make is that if someone is in crisis, that does not necessarily mean they are dangerous to everyone around them. They could be dangerous to themselves. They could be so distraught or so upset that they decide to turn their violence inward, and this is where we will see suicide. People will attack themselves, they'll hurt themselves. We see sometimes in younger people, we see self-mutilation, cutting. You know, people cut themselves repeatedly. This is an inward attack on the person because they're in crisis. They're having some kind of problem go on. So we have to determine, first of all, is it a bad day or is it crisis? If it is crisis, is it a danger to everyone around the person or is it danger just to the person? Or, as in the case of an active shooter, when these people have a problem and go off, very often they are suicidal. They attack and they kill innocent people or people they have a grudge against, and then they turn the violence on themselves and kill themselves. This creates this no-win scenario for everyone. So if you are put in that position, now it doesn't matter who you are, because I say all the time, anyone can find themselves in the position of having to deal with a person in crisis. What is it we do about that? You know, it's not always what we say. It's sometimes how we say it. It's not always what we say or how we say it. Sometimes it's the words we use. So I think one of the next things we have to determine is to try and understand what we have in front of us and how to see past our own perceptions. If you think about that for a second. When someone sees the world only through their own eyes, this is where you'll see, no matter what else is going on, people see the world through what they see as normal, as what they see as appropriate, as what they see as the way things should be. So if you've ever been in an argument with someone and it starts to get heated and the argument starts to get loud and people are getting upset, have you ever seen somebody say something like, hey, just calm down, right? Now, when me and Mrs. Lieutenant Joe are having an argument, and I got to tell you, normally it's because of something that I've done. I'll freely admit that. Something I've done or said, or I was not thinking do much, and I said or did something. So there you go. I've also learned to just apologize right away. I'm just saying it's easier that way sometimes. But the reality is, if I only see the world based on my opinion, if I'm not seeing, and in this example, if I'm not seeing that Miss Kathy, my wife, is upset about something that I have said or done, or even if it's not something I've said or done, it's about something else, I just see in her reactions and her behaviors that she is upset, and I'm not taking a moment to think about why could she possibly be upset? What is this all about? Sometimes I'm just busy. Sometimes I'm just not in the mood to deal with it. That's just the reality. But she's upset, and then I will turn around and say something back, something like, would you just calm down? Now I'm going to ask you from your own personal life experience. Have you ever been involved with someone and having an argument, and when you say to them, calm down, does that normally work? Does that usually make them go, gee, you know, you're right. I'm really upset. I'm angry. I'm voicing my opinion here. Thanks for telling me I should just calm down, and now I will. Does that ever really work? No, it doesn't really work. As a matter of fact, it has the opposite effect in many instances. Telling someone to calm down when they're that upset can be a trigger event, okay? So as we go through all these things, we have to understand these different processes, right? So a trigger event, just like when I teach the class live, I say to the class, what is a trigger and what does a trigger do on a gun, right? And I'll look around and people say, well, you pull the trigger and the gun shoots. Yes, so the trigger, when you pull the trigger, it has the effect is that the gun then functions and fires the bullet. Right? So a trigger in an emotional event is the thing that happened that set the person off. Now they could be on edge for a very long time without going off, right? Without the gun firing. You can have a loaded gun and carry it around all the time. It never goes off until you pull that trigger or until the trigger is pulled either by accident or some other means. So the reality is that an emotional trigger can be anything. that happens to somebody. All right? Anything that happens to somebody that sets them off. It can certainly be if someone is in this pandemic and they find themselves very, very upset. Just about in general. Maybe they don't know why. They're just feeling upset. There's a thing called languishing. All right. If you don't know what this is a term that's being used now to describe what it's feeling like to be stuck in this pandemic for over a year now. It's called languishing, where you feel like you're walking through mud. Everything is very slow. There's no particular thing that's got you that upset. It's just a matter of you're slow walking everything. People are losing their energy. They're losing their interest in things, where it's just because the world is shut down. You know, there's so many decisions to make here. You know, are we getting truths? Are we not getting truths about the virus? Are we getting truths or not truths about the vaccine? You know, is it really good for you? Is it not good for you? Is it healthy, unhealthy? Will it stop the pandemic? Won't stop the pandemic? You know, we have all this information going on, and then there's the fear factor that what's going to happen next. And this is why I'm saying this affects people to different levels in their lives. Some people don't get affected by it too much at all. They're pretty much just moving along. They have good coping mechanisms. Maybe they don't have a lot of fear about catching a virus and dying. And then other people, seemingly people who should not be concerned about that, young people, young healthy people, may be consumed with the idea that if they catch the virus, they're going to die. And they don't want to die. So therefore, they're on edge all the time. So these are the different kind of factors we need to think about. So someone, when you first notice that someone is a little bit off, right? We have to look at things from a different perspective, not from our perspective, where we say, hey, it's no big deal. The COVID, yeah, it's bad if you get it and you have comorbidities. But other than that, you're okay. We got to understand not everyone sees it that way. Now, I'm not talking specifics about the COVID, but I'm using that as an example where someone who can be trapped in this pandemic for the last over a year now, they're feeling this languishing feeling that they're moving through concrete, you know, and they're upset. Maybe they're scared. Maybe someone in their family did get it. Maybe they had a very hard time with it and they have lingering effects. Whatever it is, they're upset over this entire thing. And now all of a sudden there's another emotional trigger. Maybe because they're stuck at home. We know that the incidence of domestic violence have gone up immeasurably in this pandemic because people are stuck home all the time, right? These tensions, this languishing, this concern, even whether it's very pronounced or not, is on everyone's mind. We're all dealing with it. What if there's a loss of money? Maybe you're getting your unemployment check, but it's not enough to live the lifestyle you were living. You know, how do you continue on? All these kind of stresses build up on people. Add to that domestic violence, or add to that some other kind of personal stressor, and that can lead someone to get pushed over the edge. Now, add alcohol and drugs, and the lowering of inhibitions that alcohol and drugs can also add to the situation. This is the powder keg that we could find ourselves in. So when I teach this kind of thing, dealing with people in crisis, the term out there now is de-escalation. That's big in the police world, de-escalation training. But really, it should be big for everybody, because that's what we really need to do, right? We need to de-escalate someone's crisis, or to help them de-escalate themselves so that they don't erupt in violence. All right, so let's review for a second. One of the things we said we have to understand right off the bat, is it a crisis or a bad day? So that's one of our first hallmark decisions we have to make. So if you have a person who's acting in a way, agitated, loud, argumentative, or maybe very, very quiet and depressed, maybe they're writing things, right? And sometimes in younger people, they write these things down. They make hit lists. They certainly turn to violent things in other ways. So if you see a strange change in somebody's personality, that can be an indicator that someone is having some kind of a personal crisis, right? So that's your first step. Gee, is this person just having a bad day or a crisis? I have to look at it now from their perspective, not my perspective. I may think it's no big deal what's going on, but to them, maybe it is a big deal. So how we talk to people, the questions that we ask can make a difference. So open-ended questions are usually the best way to elicit information from anyone. When I teach about interview and interrogation techniques, one of the things I talk about is open-ended questions helps to solicit information from a person, to draw them out, as opposed to a pointed question. Gee, are you all upset over the COVID? Now that's a pointed question. Now to the person who's having a very bad day or they're in crisis, they might not be worrying so much about the COVID, though that may be a contributing factor. They may be upset about the lockdowns and the fact that they can't go to work, or maybe they lost their job and they're afraid they're not going to get it back. That is what's bothering them. And I ask them a question about the COVID, and in their mind, it's not necessarily the COVID. It's what happened because of the COVID, which has led them to this position of being so upset. So an open-ended question, something like, hey, you seem really upset today. Is something bothering you? Right? Now that allows that person the freedom to answer and to say, you know, dude, what am I going to do? I lost my job, you know, blah, blah, et cetera. Oh, now, see, and the key to this, and I know I'm going quick with all this. That's why you should always take my courses. Right? You should take my courses so you understand these things. The key to this is to understand that if you think of a red balloon, and a red balloon is the person and the things that are affecting them. And when the red balloon is blown up just a little bit, it's okay. It's strong. It's pliable. It's, you know, it is what it is. But you keep blowing air into that balloon, and that balloon expands and gets bigger and bigger and bigger, right? We start to see that the balloon starts to stretch. And we know at some point it's going to stretch beyond its ability to maintain its form, and it's going to pop. And when that balloon pops, that's a violent event. Well, when we look at people, if we think of people like that red balloon, as the crisis starts to expand around them, as they start to deal with this and feel this, it's like that red balloon expanding and expanding. When you notice that and you see that, what you might want to try and do, especially if you're stuck in a position to have to deal with that person, say you're on a bus, in a mall, in a movie theater, you're a police officer and you're having to deal with someone on a call, right? You're at home with a family member who's starting to go off, or a neighbor, and you start to see that balloon expanding. You want to try and de-escalate them, vent that balloon down so it doesn't pop, so there is no violence, right? And that's really the idea. So we do that by using the right words, open-ended sentences. Hey, how are you? Right? Another thing that we can do, another tactic, is that we can do what's called emotionally label what people are doing. All right, so when you hear somebody, the whole idea of emotionally labeling is that human beings have a tendency that when they're upset, if they hear their emotion spoken to them, if they hear the word, you know, happy, sad, mad, glad, and they're feeling that emotion, they'll respond to it. So if you say to somebody, boy, you seem really upset today, they will often respond back to you, I am upset today. You know, what about this, that. Now, every time they do that, even if it comes out fast-paced and intense and angry, every time they're talking, all right, talking equals life. That's what we talk about in this thing. Talking equals life. If people are talking, they're not erupting in violence. You are helping them to vent the balloon, right? You're helping them to come down in their stress level by allowing them to vent themselves. What lots of people will say is that when they're in crisis, when they're upset, it's because no one is actually listening to them. One of the biggest truths about human beings and communication is that we do not always listen to understand the other person. We listen to respond to the other person. So if you and I are talking about sports, and I like the Mets and you like the Cleveland Indians, we're going round and round. Now we get into a conflict of which is a better team. We're going to stop talking about the fundamentals of baseball, the fun of going to the stadium, the smell of the green grass, the hot dog and the beer. Now we're going to start talking about who's a better player. And you start to say, well, Johnson has got a home run. No, he doesn't. And you respond, but now you're not listening to understand what the other person's saying. You're listening to respond. So when we do that, when we use the wrong words, when we say things from our point of view that doesn't help the person in crisis to vent whatever's bothering them, all we're doing is listening to respond, and that can amp someone up. That increases what's in the balloon, right? You get that idea? So open-ended questions And then use emotional labeling. That means when you hear an emotion, you repeat it back to the person. So you might say, man, you sound really mad. You sound really sad. Boy, you sound really upset. You sound really hurt, right? And the people will respond usually, hurt. I am hurt. Can you believe that I'm home trying to do the best I can and my wife doesn't understand how hard it is not to have a job or whatever the circumstance is, right? And then you hear a tone change when that person expresses that. And, you know, and I don't know what's going to happen in my marriage, you know. Boy, you sound really sad that you can have a problem in your marriage. Sad, we've been together 20 years, I love her, but you know what, we can't live like this anymore, right? You sound really frustrated. So you just chase the emotion around. This could take 15 minutes or this could take 2 hours. It doesn't depend. There's no rule on this. But each time you do that, you emotionally label something, it helps the person to respond and it helps them to vent some of that anger or upsetness or whatever they have, and that lowers the tension. And at some point, when person is in crisis, if you're doing it properly, you're asking open-ended questions, you're emotionally labeling, you are trying to help them see it a different way, you're not judging, you're just helping them to vent. At some point, that balloon gets down to the point where it's almost normal. And no matter what they've done up to that point, even if they've done something bad, hit somebody, taken somebody into a room, smashed things, made threats, had a weapon, whatever, at some point when they calm back down, all right, when they calm back down, when the balloon is back down to normal because they vented enough, now their perspective will change and that crisis often will dissipate. Now their concern comes to consequences for what they did. Right. So say you punch somebody in the face and you're in this crisis and you won't let anybody leave a room. Right. At the office, at work, it happens. Right. What are you going to do? And you're angry. And it's just like being angry in a real argument when you get yourself all worked up. You know, at some point when you calm down, you start to look around and go, what did I do? Right. When you gain control of yourselves, even in an argument with a loved one or someone else, you start to realize, geez, what did I do here? Now what's going to happen? Well, when they get to that point, now what's going to happen? That can also be a trigger point because now they can turn that violence inward on themselves and maybe commit suicide because they realize they've done something bad. Or if you've created that little bit of a relationship with them where they see you as a lifeline, that's maybe where you can reach out and help. Hey, listen, what can I do to help you? Do you want to go to the hospital and talk to somebody? Do you want to go talk to the doctor? You know, do you want a glass of water? Whatever it is to help them to calm down. Do you need somebody to, do you want me to help? Are you injured? Do you want me to help clean that up? Whatever it is, there's that moment that crisis comes back down. The balloon comes back down and there's clarity now. And now the consequences are the concern and you can help them through that, get them the help they need, whether that's calling for help, maybe the police come at that point or you take them to the hospital, whatever it is, or you are the police, you take them off to the hospital. So the whole idea with a crisis is to recognize what's going on and then respond appropriately to the person. Don't just be going crazy with them. Make sure you do the right thing. Okay, so this is what we want to talk about today. This crisis is extremely important, and there's more where that came from.
Is a record player the best way to listen to music? Of course not. So why are you still taking vitamins that haven't been upgraded since the 1930s? Even if your vitamins aren't hard to swallow, it's time to upgrade to Healthy Cells pill-free, patent-pending microgel supplements that work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. They taste great, convenient on the go, and they're more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
One of the things I like to talk about, you know, it's not really the light side of police work, it's the other side of police work. There's things that all officers will do over the course of their career, and it's called telling war stories. Now, war stories can be truths, They can be things that really happened to you. They can be based on an officer's perception of how things went. The stories can be terrifying. They can be funny. Lots of them are funny, really, really funny. Or they can be problematic. The story is told, but it's really not exactly how it happened. And then other people will remember it differently, and it could cause problems. Well, so many things happen to you in the course of a law enforcement career that are scary, funny, sad, painful, wonderful, exciting, unbelievable. All of these kind of emotions can come your way when you're dealing with a career in law enforcement. Doesn't matter what it is you're doing, because you're dealing with people. Well, I have always called it a backstage pass to life. All right, the backstage pass to life, what that really means is, because you're a police officer, you end up in people's lives at different times and in different ways and for all kinds of different reasons. You know, people call you to their home when there's something going on. You stop people in the middle of things that they're doing, good, bad, or indifferent. Sometimes you'll have a search warrant as part of an investigation, and the judge will give you a search warrant. And that search warrant, if you've never seen one, that search warrant says, I command you to go do A, B, C, and D. This is a command from the judge, from the court, telling the officer to go do something. Normally, it's kick in somebody's door and go through their stuff to try and find evidence that you need for a criminal case. But whatever it is, no matter what it is that's going on, the reality of these kind of things is that every officer has these stories, and they start to build from day one. I mean, I can remember, you sit around with a bunch of cops, and they will start talking about, when I was in the academy, we had this guy who was in the class who did this, or we had this drill sergeant that would chase us around. And those stories can be funny because they are a binding element of law enforcement. Think about your own time in the police academy. It was weird, I guess. Maybe when you first got there, you didn't know what to expect. Sometimes these drill sergeants chase you around. Sometimes you go to a police academy where it's a lot more relaxed than other places. I know the one I went to, we're supposed to start at 7 a.m. So here's all these young recruits showing up in our recruit uniforms, not really knowing what to do. We're all from different towns, and we're going to go through this police academy thing. We're going to be cops. So it was new. It was exciting. It was scary. We weren't sure, and we show up, and everybody's parking their cars in this big, giant dirt stone driveway, and the police academy was probably 100 yards away or so. And I think everyone had pretty much the same idea. We're supposed to start at 7. They tell you, show up at the academy at 7 a.m., and we're all there at like 6:20, 6:30. So what do? You show up someplace early. You're expecting to get going at 7. So you're thinking, hey, pretty good, man. I got here early. This is excellent. This is really great. So you get out of the car. You're checking your equipment, because the first day you go in my academy, you had to bring like a lot of the stuff you were going to need for your entire 22 weeks you were going to be there. So at some point you were going to shoot guns. It's part of what cops do. So you had to bring a shotgun. You had to bring thousands of rounds of ammunition. That's heavy stuff, right? So, usually if there's a couple of cops from the same department going through the academy, one person's going to carry the guns, one will carry the ammo. This is what you're trying to work out. So we all pull in there, and there was probably, 20 of us there at 6:30. And we're getting out of our cars, and we're starting to sort our stuff, and, seeing do you know somebody, you're talking to the people next to you. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I don't know where this guy came. He was about 5'7". A young Asian guy from the sheriff's department, and he came out. He was one of the drill sergeants. And this guy came out of nowhere with the campaign hat on, the press. He came running across that parking lot, screaming at the top of his lungs at all of us for standing around in his parking lot. And I'm telling you, we were shocked. We had no idea. And he starts screaming at people and yelling and making people run up, close them doors, get over to that academy. And we're like, oh my God, we're here early. We're getting treated like this. It was crazy. Drill Allen, Paul Allen was his name. Very, very good man. Over the course of my career, I became friends with him. But I will never forget the first time I saw Paul Allen. I mean, blood in his eyes, fire in his smoke coming out of his mouth as he ran, 5'7" of them, across that parking lot, screaming at us like we were pieces of garbage, and he let us know. It's that kind of a story It's that kind of a story about, you know, your academy. And I could tell you stories endlessly about the academy. You're there for 22 weeks and you're going through all this change and, you know, these things. Well, every cop has these kind of stories, you know, and then you get out on the road. They could tell you stories about their first day. They could tell you the first time when they were sent off on their own. They weren't with an FTO. They could tell you the first time they went on a really traumatic call, the first fatal accident, whatever it is. There's thousands and thousands of these stories. And I'm trying to compile them. I'm trying to put them together in what I call tales from the road, okay? Because that's really what they are. They're stories. They're tales from the road from some people's careers. And myself and my partners, my blood brothers out there, we sat down and we recorded one time a couple of hours of us just, you know, let's just reminisce. And that's what we did. We sat around talking about, do you remember that case? You remember that case? And I said, wait a minute. This is pretty interesting stuff. We should really document this. And I've asked all of them to write down their stories and send them to me. And actually, a couple of the fellas have. But I'm going to be telling tales from the road from time to time. So this is actually Tales from the Road number one. And you've already heard about my first 5 minutes in the police academy. But I'm going to go through cases, going to talk about events, things that I learned, lessons that I learned about humanity, about myself, about the job, about how all these things intersect. Some of them are funny. I mean, some of these stories are hysterical. The things that people say and do are just unbelievable. And then there's some things that are terrifying, and there's other things that can change you as a human being. Now, when I say this, I want to be really clear about something. These tales from the road, they serve a couple of purposes, at least for me, and I hope for you, if you're a law enforcement officer out there and you're trying to understand your life, and if you're not an officer, you're trying to understand what goes on with cops, is to understand that the reality is that law enforcement officers are prone to suicide almost more than any other profession. Now, when they look at professionals that commit suicide, you find that it's police officers and dentists. And they go back and forth in one and two. Why dentists? I don't know. If there's a dentist out there, you want to call in and tell me, are you depressed? Are you upset? I mean, why are you looking to kill yourself? You know, cops, you can almost understand the stress that they're under, the horrible things that they see, that this could lead to emotional trauma. You know, we talked in a previous episode about crisis and being in crisis, what leads people to crisis. Well, you could see where police work might do that to somebody. But the reality is, you know, how do we get past that? And that's part of my goal that I'm working for, is to try and help my brother and sister officers to get through their lives without doing such a terrible thing to themselves. And I say lives, not their career, because when we look statistically, we see that police officers that commit suicide don't do it just when they're active duty officers. Sometimes years later in their careers, they will commit suicide. And I believe that it is based on years of seeing traumatic things, feeling traumatic things, and not dealing with them appropriately. Okay? I do a lot of writing. I write for Blue Magazine. I write for a lot of the FBI Magazine, a lot of other types of periodicals and stuff. And the first article I ever wrote was called The Tragic Toll of Police Work. Now, you will find that on my police subscription page. In our first month, we put that article out because we think that that's important for people to understand the tragic toll of police work. I had been a cop not for very long, a couple of years maybe, when a friend of mine, a childhood friend, who I hadn't seen in many, many years, you know, we kind of separated when we got older, started getting married and all that kind of stuff. And then I found out that this person was a cop also in another town, not far away, 25, 30 miles away. I had no idea that this person turned out to be a cop, just like I did. And then one day I heard that he committed suicide, that he killed himself. And I was in shock. I never knew anyone who killed themselves. I knew people did. And I knew, let me strike that. Not that I didn't know anybody who did that. I didn't know anybody personally in my direct connected sphere of life that killed themselves. And I knew people who did it, and it was kind of a mystery, but it's just like, oh, well, that person moved to California. Well, that person killed themselves. Why would they do that, right? Well, when this officer killed himself, it was a shock to my senses because in all honesty, in my mental state, I could never imagine doing that. You know, I've made jokes. I've said, you know, if things got that bad, I would take off and I would go and be a pool boy in the South Pacific somewhere. Sir, would you like another towel? Would you like a margarita, ma'am? You know, that's what I would do to handle my stress. And I don't mean to make light of it. I'm simply saying that's what I always thought. I never, the idea of killing myself has never come up in my head. It's not something maybe I'll be better off dead. But I know it does for a lot of people. And I know it does for a lot of my brothers and sisters. Right now, there's thousands and thousands of officers listening to me tell these stories. And the reality is, I think it's like one in 75 police officers during their career or after in retirement will kill themselves. That is a lot of people. And I think I got that statistic right. I know the number is astronomical. It's shocking. And one of the things I've decided to try and do with whatever ability I have is to try and prevent that. Try and prevent people from hurting themselves, from killing themselves, right? My brother and sister officers, they are good, noble, and decent people. And they spend their lives serving. And sometimes the things that they see, hear, smell, experience during the career is something that is like a cancer and it can grow inside of you. So the whole idea of Tales from the Road is, when I first thought of it, was a venting for me. You know, let me vent these things out, the funny stories, the scary stories, the horrible stories, and get them out. As I started to examine them, I started to realize, you know, I've been in a very lucky place myself in that I figured this out early on. When I wrote that article, The Tragic Toll of Police Work, I really vented my soul out there trying to say, I can't believe this happened, and why would people do it? So then, of course, I went and I did some research, and I started to find out about police suicide and why people do it. And my article was about trying to say, here's what we can do. We can stop with the gallows humor. I mean, this is what cops do. Cops use gallows humor. You know, we see something horrible and they make jokes about it. And I say all the time, you know, if people ever heard us talking about this, whatever the situation was, some horrible thing that happened, and cops are making jokes. Now, they're not making jokes because they're idiots and they're fools and nasty people. They're making jokes because that is a coping mechanism with seeing something so horrific and terrible. So one of the things they do, they make light of it. See, it's not affecting me. I'm a tough guy. I'm a tough girl. Aha, that's funny. That's funny. When it's really not funny. And just like a cancer, a malignant cancer, if we don't deal with that appropriately, and laughing it off is not appropriate, all right? If we don't deal with what it is, you know, the first time you see a baby that's shaken to death, right, by its mother or father, the first time you see someone who's brutally assaulted or murdered, or you see some other horrible things, it can live in you. And that's what I see happens to a lot of cops. Well, I realized that when I started to research, and I said, man, I've seen a lot of bad things. I'm not letting those things live with me. There's a great picture, a meme I saw on social media, and it was the back of an ambulance, and it was an ambulance worker sitting like at the back door. The back doors are open. The ambulance worker is sitting there, and they got their head in their hands, and there's ghosts of all these people around them, little children who died in accidents, elderly people who died from heart attacks, and all the ghosts are around them, and this person is feeling them. Well, that is what causes people to succumb to that tragic toll of police work. And I think if you can find a way to deal with it, if you can find a way to put those feelings in the right compartment, in the box, to not let them have power over you, you can live through your career, you can live through your retirement and be better. So Tales from the Road is really about venting ourselves. So my brother and sisters, if you have stories you want to tell, good, bad, scary, indifferent, if you want to come on the program and talk with me, I would love it. If you want to write them down and send them to me, I will give you credit in the book, and I will add them in there, because hopefully it's going to be Tales from the Road, Volume 1 through 50. All right, so you can reach out to me at jpangaro@truesecuritydesign.com and send me your stories, send me your comments, whatever it is that you want to do. I'd like to have you come on and talk about different things. So thank you, everybody. I appreciate you being here. I want you to pray for our friends in Israel and for peace around the world. This is Lieutenant Joe for Chasing Justice saying, remember, be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. We'll see you next time.